Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we're delighted to have I.S. Berry with us this afternoon talking about her book, The Peacock and the Sparrow. Sorry to get that straight. And the author has kindly signed some copies for us, but we're kind of running out. But I will put a link. We only have that few yeah. left. And I will go ahead and put a buy link in the comments field should you wish to purchase one. And also joining us, we're very grateful to have Joseph Cannon with us today. He's going to be talking to Ilana and Barbara tuning in from home, as always. And I will be monitoring the comments field. So if you have questions for our authors today, go ahead and put them in. And Barbara will bring me back on screen towards the end of the hour. And I would be happy to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. Sorry we're a few minutes late. We had, you know, one or two technical issues to resolve.
Mea culpa. My fault today.
Oh, no. You know, it's just, I think it's miraculous that, as Patrick was saying before we started, given the volume of events, that there have been so few glitches, so few authors that didn't show up. It's amazing. Anyway, what an absolute pleasure it is to meet a new author, I.S. Berry, otherwise going to be called Ilana. I'm not going to call you I.S.
That's fine.
Right.
Ilana's right. Good.
And her background is, in fact, with experience. She was an operations officer for the CIA, serving in wartime Baghdad and elsewhere. And in this book, you will get to learn a lot about Bahrain and the Fifth Fleet, which I have to say was all sort of new to me. I have only been to Sharjah and Dubai, but never any further into the Gulf.
Yeah.
And one of my all-time favorite people and authors, Joseph Cannon, whose Los Alamos remains a complete lodestone, as far as I'm concerned, in crime fiction, has agreed to join us. And Joe, I'm laughing because I'm looking at my faux anchor behind me, which the MWA gave me because they forgot to order my Raven Award. So they gave me the anchor instead, and I refused to give it back. But Joe actually has a real Edgar, an Edgar that he won for Los Alamos. And Joe came to being a phenomenal author from a career in publishing, which I've always thought was a really interesting transition, Joe. Have we talked about that? How did that happen?
Well, there were those who say I went over to the dark side, but you could look at it from the opposite direction. It's, you know, it's a different skill set. It's not a natural movement. Once you're in publishing, you think that's really what you're going to do. I didn't have manuscripts secretly in drawers, and I wasn't imagining a complete change of life, but so it proved to be. I discovered that I really loved writing. So it happened.
Well, you have, and you have written some absolutely wonderful books. I love Los Alamos. Istanbul Passage might still remain my favorite because I think the, Ilana, you will maybe relate to this too. Joe asked the question is, what if you were on post in, let's say, Istanbul when the war ended? It just ended.
Yeah. And
what would happen to you? You know, which I think says, I mean, most spy novels are mission driven or something, but you know, to have it, why did you decide to do, sorry, we'll get to you and all that in a minute, but when I can talk to Joe, I have to ask him questions. Why did you decide to do that?
Do Istanbul?
Yeah.
It's almost a classic example of how some of my books come about because they usually start with place. I'll be somewhere and be utterly fascinated, read everything I can about it, and then it'll lead to, I mean, this is certainly what happened in Los Alamos. I went there as a tourist, and I was so struck by the look of the place and the fact that it was ordinary and all-American, and yet at one point had been the most secret place on Earth. It did not technically exist, and I thought, what was that like? I mean, what was it like to live here during those heady days? Istanbul was slightly different. I went as a tourist. Like every tourist who goes to Istanbul, I think, I fell in love with it because it's one of the great interesting cities in the world. And the more I read about it, the more the books would end with Ataturk and the 1920s. And I thought, well, what about the period that I'm interested in, which is World War II and the immediate post-war period? And I discovered that it had been one of the great listening posts for the war because it was 20 kilometers away from the hot war, the real World War II. But as a neutral city, it was a honey to the bears for spies, and they were all there. And I was reading about one evening in the Park Hotel, and I realized it was a scene out of Casablanca. There was a Japanese intelligence agent, there was a German, there was an American, And I thought, my God, it really happened. It just didn't happen in Casablanca. It happened in Istanbul. And I thought, well, there's a story worth telling. I don't know if a professional would agree with that, but it seemed to me that if you are left high and dry from the excitement and, quote, whatever glamour attached to that work during the war, now it's over. And do you just go home? What happens to you, you know, in the deflation? And another war is beginning, but it's not the same war that you were fighting. It's got different characters in it. Anyway, I'm rambling on and on about this. And in fact, we're here to talk about you, Ilana, because this book is so extraordinary. Before we went on, and I'll just repeat myself to you, I was explaining how I ended up here, which is that your editor sent me a copy of the book thinking I would like it. And indeed, I did like it very much. I thought it was terrific. I do think it's terrific. And I agreed to do this with Barbara because, oh, I can resist Barbara not at all. If she says, would you like to do this? Of course you do it. You will learn this as you continue writing these books. It's just a good thing. And I'm happy to help in any way I can. I think you're a remarkable talent, and this book is so enjoyable. And more than enjoyable, there's a lot to learn from it. I like books that teach something without being didactic, and just simply putting you in place, as I was saying, it's so important to me. I mean, some of my books are only about place, or at least they begin as being about place. And the place here is just extraordinary. It's wonderfully conveyed, and there's so much going on the page. I think your prose is terrific, and there are wonderful descriptive grace notes that really make the difference between an ordinary book and a really accomplished one. And I think you've started right out of the gate. I'm so pleased for you. I hope it does really well.
Thank you. That it means so much. And as also I was saying before we started, you were such an inspiration to me reading your novels as I was growing up and in my younger years. And, you know, it was sort of a revelation to me when I read your books, because it was like spy novels can also be great literature. And it was eye-opening for me, because there aren't, I think, a lot of literary spy novelists. And I love that your books were character-driven, and that time and place was woven so beautifully into the human stories. And that was just so unusual.
Well, Ilana, I love, of course, hearing all that, but can I offer you a piece of advice? Don't say to somebody, I loved your books when I was a little girl. I mean, it just makes me...
No, I wasn't a little girl.
Yeah, Joe, I'm the senior person on this Zoom.
Yeah, I know, but I never admit that.
A young adult.
Right. So in point of fact, I wasn't really digressing that much with Istanbul Passage, because I thought there were some parallels there, Joe, in that one doesn't normally think of Istanbul as a World War II espionage location. And in the modern world of spy fiction, Bahrain is kind of a first. You know, they're right now we've pivoted back to Russia. We spent an awful lot of time in other parts of the Middle East. We certainly have focused on the Far East, and that probably is going to be coming. But one of the things I thought was so interesting was to go to a storied city with a, you know, cultural mix. And in turn, it's actually the headquarters of the American Fifth Fleet, which was really a surprise to me, because I guess I never really thought about the Fifth Fleet before. So I thought you addressed some of the same things in the book that Joe addressed in Istanbul Passage, partly due to the career of your main character. So how did you translate your own experience in the CIA into fiction?
I mean, for me, what really haunted me from my days spying was sort of the unanswered questions that you have to kind of make these decisions that affect people's lives in a world where there's no clear right and wrong, and there's no clear good and bad. And I definitely experienced that. I spent a year in Baghdad during the war, 2004 to 2005. And, you know, one of my most haunting and affecting memories was helping to apprehend a alleged terrorist, only to find later on that we might not have gotten the right guy. We weren't sure if he was guilty. Years after it was through my informant that we were able to help track this guy down, and he never confessed. And years later, he was still detained. And it was sort of a moment of just of reckoning for me, where I realized, you know, in this fog of war and espionage, I had made a decision that affected someone's life, and I don't know if it was the right decision or not, but it was something that haunted me. And I don't think I realized how much it haunted me until the years passed. And at some point I just felt like I really had to put it on paper. And I think, you know, in so many ways, the peacock and the sparrow is about the things that haunt us. It's, you know, the protagonist is sort of caught in the crosswinds of the Arab Spring and makes decisions that affect the course of the Arab Spring, and that they have pretty grave consequences.
I keep wanting to call this book The Sparrow and the Scorpion, and I'm still trying to figure, no, I'm serious, and I'm trying to figure out whether that's some sort of, you know, the scorpion thing is my reaction in part to the story. I don't know. So Joe, you probably have all kinds of penetrating questions, so why don't I just sit back here and turn it over to you?
Well, we can talk about the CIA and other penetrating issues, but I just want to get one thing done first, because I think it's really interesting from a writing point of view. Can I ask, the book is told from the point of view of a man, and indeed told in the first person, and there's no effort made to hide the fact that you're a woman. I mean, you know, even though it's IS as initials, you're not pretending to be something else. How did you come to make the decision to write from, I mean, it's not usual that this happens.
Right. Yeah, that's the number one question I get. And it's funny, because when I set out to write the book, I just set out to write the best book I could. And really, I wanted to write about a typical spy. And a typical spy who had been kind of worn down from years of manipulating. He's an alcoholic. He's a bit of a womanizer. And to be honest, that was kind of typical in my experience, more typical than a woman would have been. And and the other reason is, you know, a woman operating in the Middle East faces a host of constraints and limitations. I mean, I operated in the Middle East for a year, and just operational limitations that I think would have been distracting from the story. I mean, it would have been hard for a woman, you know, to penetrate the opposition, for example. I mean, that just, it just wouldn't have been as plausible.
Well, I agree. I mean, I always keep thinking of those scenes in Homeland when Claire Danes is abroad and puts on a headscarf, and you'd think, oh, it's Claire Danes in a headscarf. You know, you can't believe that anybody's really falling for this.
Exactly.
And I was assuming that this was a more typical experience. It's nevertheless, just from a technical point of view, an interesting literary decision to make. It's hard to cross gender in that way. I mean, there's no reason not to try, and there's no reason that you shouldn't have done it. And there wasn't a single moment in the book when I thought it was off kilter in any way. It was just...
Thank you.
Had IS been, you know, Irving or something, it would have been the same. But that's an accomplishment. I think it's very hard to do.
Thank you. I mean, I feel like I've worked in largely male professions for a while now. As a spy, I worked as an intel analyst for Department of Defense. And so I had a lot of material to draw from.
And you're very good with the other men in the story as well. So the interactions are all perfectly plausible.
Thank you.
I wanted to put that behind us because it's one of those things that I think will interest people. Because it's a rare, but much more interesting to me is, how long were you with the CIA, in fact?
6 years.
I mean, are you still? I don't know.
No, I left in 2008. It wasn't a great fit for me, to be honest. I think maybe that comes out in the book. I found it kind of a distasteful profession. I mean, your whole job is to manipulate people, to convince them to betray their country, their family, their tribe. So, you know, just it wasn't the right profession for me.
Is there a statute of limitations? I mean, do you have to go through a process to write?
Yes, you absolutely have to have everything cleared, nonfiction or fiction. I have to have everything cleared for my entire life, anything that even mentions the CIA. And the agency's rule is you have to, their definition of publishing is showing it to anyone. So I basically wrote it in a vacuum for, you know, about 5 years. I couldn't even show my husband. I couldn't show anyone. It was kind of lonely. It was a leap of faith. I would park myself in a Starbucks every day and sit and write and not having any idea whether it was any good at all.
And how would it have worked in practice? I mean, is it an arbitrary decision? You give it to somebody, they read it, and if they say, no, you're not publishing this, you can?
Pretty much. I mean, there's something called the Publication Review Board. But unless you're literally cutting and pasting a classified document, which of course you wouldn't be doing, it's a subjective decision. It's basically, I mean, when you're talking about literature or writing, I mean, it's somebody judging whether they think it contains classified information. Yeah. And a lot of times there have been instances, because I've submitted pieces over the years, where they'll redact something and then you come back and you say, no, you're wrong. This isn't classified. And then they'll say, you're right. Okay.
But perhaps they're more used to doing this because over the years, so many people have from the agency have in fact written and published. I mean, at one point, nobody had.
That's true. There are quite a few. Yeah.
I mean, I'm constantly asked, particularly if I'm in DC at some event, and they'll say, well, as for your relationship with the agency, and I'll say, I have none. I was never asked. I was never part of it. Never. And they usually say, well, of course, you would have to say that, wouldn't you? And so you never win. So I just let it roll away.
Yes.
It's just the CIA, Joe. I think some of the military fiction writers who've actually served, they mm-hmm. too have to go through a process. So it's not exclusive to the spy agency that kind of review happens. And apparently you can challenge it. And as Alana says, you can often overcome their objections.
Yeah.
Loop, you know, because the number of people who actually have been with the agency who write set the stage for people who haven't. How would we know? I mean, someone once said, well, what about this instance of tradecraft? And I said, oh, it's just something I read somewhere. But the important thing is that office life tends to a similarity no matter what the business is. And if you've worked in any kind of office, I mean, the portrait here of the station in Bahrain and how the people are interacting with each other and who's a drag and who's, you know, going to be a snitch, etc. You don't have to be in the CIA to have had this kind of office experience. And so I think you just transport it from another business, so to speak, which may be disillusioning to people who think that it's meant to be an extreme organization. My own take on this is the people who have written about it really focus on the ordinariness of the day-to-day and what actually the work is. But can I ask a slightly off that subject question? One of the things that always interests me is how you recruit informants in the first place. I mean, why do they do it? We're not talking about people in the 30s who are ideologically committed to, let's say, the success of communism versus capitalism, or, you know, who think of it almost as a kind of church. This is the year 2015 or 2018. I mean, why would someone take that risk?
Hey, that's a good question. I mean, my experience was a little atypical in that I was in a war zone. And so I think my guess was the primary motivation was money, and maybe some hope of safety of some kind. I think they, you know, typically they would walk our sources. We were pretty much confined to the green zone and sources would walk in. So it was kind of like they wanted something from the Americans. But in a regular peacetime setting, I mean, it's a good question. I think there's a lot of narcissism involved. I mean, I think that's maybe the number one reason. I think it really fulfills something in some people that they, you know, the fate of a nation rests on them. They have their nation's secrets and they can betray their country. So I think it's kind of a psychology of
psychology. I always thought that Kim Philby operated out of narcissism
exactly.
more than he did out of ideology. I don't know, Joe, what do you think? Have you
I agree with that. I think there's an element of who's the smartest guy in the room, and he's sitting at the table and it's, I know something and you don't, and you don't know that I know. And there's a kind of gratification to that. It's a perverse gratification, but I think it does exist.
I mean, I don't know if you remember, just, I don't know, maybe a couple years ago, there was this couple that was caught not far from where I live in, I want to say it was Annapolis, Maryland, and they had been selling, I think they were selling naval intelligence secrets. You remember what, and I remember they hid the secrets in like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. But it was like this ordinary suburban couple. And you're like, what possible reason would they have to sell out their country?
Well, some of it's money, but you know what I think is interesting is this kid, whatever, Texera, I can't remember just how to pronounce his name, but it's that bragging rights thing. It's that thing at the core of the whole Trump document thing. You know, I have something that nobody else has. And,
exactly.
You know, and I'm thinking that the fact that the internet, allows everyone to tell their own story in a way that never was possible before, that you could publish, in a forum and,
yes,
and be yes. recognized, that I think that we're back to that sort of bragging rights thing that, maybe it's going to become more powerful than money, because maybe it also leads to money. I mean, maybe it's kind of an influencer thing. I don't know. I found him really an interesting question. You know, was he just showing off in the gaming world, or was it that he could one up everybody around him because he had these cool documents that gave him status? And maybe it's a desire to be seen in some rather than being one up.
Right.
And like, it's also the case of someone who becomes an agent or a spy for legitimate ideological reasons, that they had truly believed in what they were doing and are now trapped in. How do you get out once you're in? I mean, I'm thinking of the Cambridge spies from the 30s, and once you put in that kind of time and are clearly guilty of that level of treason, you don't just walk away from it. It's very difficult. And I think that so much of the disillusion that becomes part of the atmospheric background in those novels stems from this, the fact that they may not any longer believe in what they had once believed.
Yeah.
It's too late and they're stuck with it. But when you first, I hate to keep asking about the agency, but everybody's fascinated by it. So, and here's a chance. How did you come to join it? I mean, what was the process? Were you asked or did you apply?
No, and I don't know that they do ask people anymore. I feel like that's sort of an urban legend. Maybe back in the day they did, but no, I just applied. I really had an acute interest in foreign affairs. I'd studied abroad and I just loved international politics. So I had started off as an intelligence analyst for the Department of Defense, but I was overseas. I was stationed in Cambridge, England, but I would go back and forth to the Balkans. And this was like in the 90s, kind of post-Dayton Accords, which was such, I mean, even that conflict was so interesting, and there was no clear right side in the Balkans War as well. And so that was sort of what spurred my interest. And the next logical step was to apply to the CIA.
And was the fact that you were a woman difficult in the Mideast? I mean, I'm just assuming that it created problems that it would not have created somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it was, like I said, it was a little bit of an atypical situation just because it was a war zone and we were kind of locked up in the green zone, where it was this kind of this fortified area where, the Iraqis who walked in knew what they were dealing with. It was a little Western enclave. So it wasn't quite the same as if I were out and about operating on the streets of Baghdad. But I had sources, I had informants who wouldn't look me in the eye, wouldn't shake my hand, who would hint that they preferred to work with my male colleagues. So it was an issue. It was also an issue with my agency colleagues. it's there's some sexism still at the agency.
Some. I like the way you say some. That's a pretty soft approach all the way around there, Elena. But actually, the more of the people writing spy fiction have worked in the Asia, I think it's more women who are actually writing, having worked there. I'm thinking about Francine Matthews, yourself, Alma Katsu,
yeah, I know her.
Interesting. I'll have to think about which men. I find that men are coming from the military, writing military fiction more than. But then we go back to, you know, Ian Fleming and Le Carre, both of whom actually served. I mean, Ian Fleming, you know, do you think the OSS ever made him like vet a James Bond book, or was it so clearly fiction that nobody cared?
For Ian Fleming?
Yeah.
Well, I think MI6 would like to think it was true. And it was considered, I think, a great send up, you know, all of those. They were comic novels.
Right.
At least we see them as such now. And I think they were pretty much that then, given the names alone that he uses.
Yeah. But he did actually do some of, you know, I mean, he actually did serve in that capacity during the war. And, you know, you're right. I think he took it up to a comic level. Whereas, you know, Le Carre took it down. I mean, you know, my husband read this and he loved it. He said he thought it reminded him so much of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, because there's that kind of Le Carre sensibility to it that I thought you did. Well, tell me about Amaísa, because, you know, we've talked about everything, but there's a woman. Wow, is there always going to be a woman in this situation?
Yeah, well, I mean, partly because the protagonist was male, I really wanted an interesting female character. So that was important to me. And, you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but in some ways I feel like she's the she's the smartest of the bunch, and sort of in her own way, I don't want to give it away, but she's kind of is crafty in her own way and kind of outsmart the rest of them.
Now, Joe, in your experience, you know, could you write a really great spy novel where it's just, there's no intersex play? It's just like all guys, or possibly even all women, but probably all guys.
You could, but it wouldn't be nearly as much fun. And, you know, I think writing about intimacy and love and sex is where we are truly at our most vulnerable and the most revealing of character. And it's a shame to avoid those subjects. I think they ought to be looked at and embraced. It's important. It's an important part of life. So how do you write without writing about that? That said, would it be possible to write a book strictly with men? Sure, I guess.
Well, if you call Rogue Nail a spy novel, although I'm not sure it's a spy novel, maybe more of a thriller, but it's basically two guys, you know, facing off all the way through it. It's one of my favorite books. I wish more people today had read it, if you want to go all the way back into spy fiction. I'm trying to remember, is the Erskine Childers just guys? Remember the Riddle of the Sands?
I only remember guys in it.
Me too. So, right. I think it was. I always find it so ironic. I don't know if you know him, Elena, but it was. Many people think it was kind of the first real spy novel. It takes place in the North Sea and kind of the marshes of northern Germany and all. And Childers was Irish. It's a wonderful book. And then when World War I was over, the British shot him as a traitor because he went back to Ireland to.
Oh my gosh.
Fight for Irish independence. You have to admit that, you know, a guy that wrote a spy novel and is then shot as a traitor by the country that he was, you know, I mean, it's a terrible, it's awful, but the irony of it is stupendous.
Yeah.
Yes. Ilana, can I ask a related thing? I mean, I think one of the joys of this book for the reader is the portrait of the expat community. And I won't say that it's satirical, it's just very sharply observed, let's put it that way. But there is something inherent in expat life that brings this out. I mean, it reminded me of other kinds of books. Was this your experience when you were there? Did you?
Yes, 100%. So when I was in Bahrain, I was not a spy. I was there for my husband's job. He worked on the naval base where the Fifth Fleet was located. So I was very much a part of the expat community. I was part of the expat wives group. And, you know, that was largely what inspired that whole part of the book, because it was so interesting to me. And so much of the dialogue in the book is literally exact dialogue that I heard while I was there. I mean, it was like, I couldn't make it up. I mean, it was just too good. Some of the things they said, you know, some of the wives making comments, oh, I love it here. You know, I can wear whatever I want. I can wear, you know, gemstones and luxury goods. And that's what they meant. Or the scene, I don't know if you remember, there was a controversy over a nativity scene on the naval base in the book. That happened in real life. People were up in arms because an atheist had objected to this nativity scene on the naval base, saying it was a violation of separation of church and state. And all the wives banded together to try to get this objector ejected from the base. I mean, it was like, as a group, like Americans kind of seemed to lose the values that they were supposed to promote.
But does this, I mean, I was thinking as I read through it, and there's also, by the way, a wonderful set piece of the Marine ball or dance. The Marines every November, I think it was in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's terrifically well done, and you really get it. But I was thinking as I read through those, how similar in so many ways the attitudes were during the British Empire. Mm-hmm. It's taking people out of their natural environment and putting them in this exalted and often privileged position.
Yes.
In foreign climes, that it just does something to people. And they become so much worse than they would be at home.
100%. I totally agree with you. It's this amplified elitism. And I think I have this paragraph in there where I tried to convey that, where I have as kind of the watering hole is Trader Vic's, which really exists in Bahrain as well. And I think I compared it to the Majestic in Saigon and the Elphinstone Club in India. I mean, it's like, anywhere you go overseas, you know, and you have, like you said, these expat communities that already come in and they're already kind of feeling superior, and then it's just amplified.
And have only themselves to fall back on. I mean, they just become such a bubble because they really don't interact for one reason or another with the general population that surrounds them, often because they can't, but in any case, they don't.
Exactly.
The result is that they're living this woo-woo kind of life, you know. Anyway, I thought you captured that wonderfully, and I'm not surprised to know that it really happened.
Yep.
Although I am not one of those people who believes that fiction is autobiography. I mean, I think this notion, I had a theory once that we have so come to accept spin in our public lives that we're demanding authenticity in our fiction. It's just ridiculous, you know. Novels are not autobiographies. But if they are drawn from something, from life that's observed and known,
yes,
it's of course that much more, you know, to the point. And certainly that was the case here. I thought it was really among the best parts of the book.
Thank you.
I did too. You know, in a way, I thought I was maybe at Raffles in Singapore, or you know,
right. Yeah.
And, you know, part of it, I think too, and you could see it in a lot of novels about the British in India, is that these are people who could not have led that more elevated lifestyle if they hadn't gone to a place where there was cheap labor and a lot of free stuff. And I think it kind of went to their heads, as Joe says, a bubble. Actually, Los Alamos, going back to your book, was a bubble. You know, you were writing about people in a bubble. It wasn't necessarily a luxury bubble. In fact, it really wasn't. But, you know, what happens when you have such an insular community? It's actually kind of an interesting variation on the Agatha Christie country house murder, you know, where you take people and put them in a closed environment and then watch the things they get up to. It makes sense. Joe, before we started this, you were talking about Alana's really gorgeous prose style. Can you repeat what you had to say, sort of? Because it was great.
It's a compliment that bears repeating. I really believe that for a book to work for me now, there's something has to happen on the page. There has to be some real interest in the writing itself. And I think this book had that in spades. There are just wonderful little touches that are put in, observations that are true. The rhythm of the prose is good throughout. I mean, it's a well-written book. I know that that's something that isn't often said now in reviews or even among word of mouth, but really, what could be more important? I mean, I think that, you know, it's the respect a writer has for his audience is just to write well or to write as well as you can. And I think you really pulled it off. It's really very good. The ultimate compliment is that I can't wait to read what's next.
Oh, thank you.
That is a wonderful compliment. So that would lead me to ask you, since you said you wrote this book largely in isolation because you had to run it by the CIA and you couldn't show it to anybody, when you finally did and an editor acquired it, was there much in the way of editorial process or not?
No, not really. I mean, it looks pretty much the same now, more or less, as when I submitted it to the agency. And the agency has gotten a little more reasonable over the years. Like now, if you make stylistic changes, you don't have to keep resubmitting it every time. But that was, to be honest, that was part of my motivation because I didn't want to have to resubmit it. I didn't want to write a sloppy draft, send it out, and then have to rework it and then resubmit it to the agency. So I really, I mean, in some ways, I think it made me a better writer because I sat down and I perfected it and made it the absolute best draft I could before anybody saw it.
Had you written anything else before you wrote this?
Not really. I had written just mostly for catharsis. I had written a memoir of sorts about my time in Baghdad. I spent a lot of time on that. It wasn't something that I ultimately wanted to try to publish just because it was too personal and it just wasn't the story I wanted to tell. But it did. I just spent a lot of years just kind of working on that. And I think that honed my writing skills.
So what are you working on now? Because hardly any publisher ever buys one book anymore, right? usually it's two.
Well, so I'm actually, I'm reworking and fictionalizing my experience in Baghdad. And it's going to have a female protagonist. And it's going to be about focusing on the story I mentioned earlier about how I helped apprehend this spy, only to later find that he might not be guilty. And sort of a darkness at noon theme where, you know, when someone becomes the victim of the system that they helped to create.
Wow.
Wonderful idea.
Thank you.
So. Wonderful idea. Joe, what are you up to?
Well, the new one that's coming, since you asked, Barbara, because I think you'll be getting a copy soon. The next is called Shanghai, and it's set in Shanghai in 1939.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. It'll
be published in the spring. They take months and months now to publish a book, but who am I to say? I'm no longer in the business. So.
Well, that's all right. Spring in Arizona is way better than summer. So if you're publishing in the spring, I have a decent shot at getting you here.
Yes, you do.
That's wonderful. You know, I still remember, I mean, I've only been to Shanghai once, and it was 1997. And so China was in, or, you know, Hong Kong was at that moment when it was no longer British, but it wasn't yet quite Chinese. And Hong Kong was still older Hong Kong, that island that now looks like, you know, downtown Sydney or whatever it is. There wasn't even anything there. And we went to Macau and it was still like temples and Portuguese stuff. There was no giant gambling thing or whatever it is. I can hardly believe how it's transformed. And I don't want to go back except in books because I think it would be so disappointing.
Well, and now it's very hard. I mean, I had been to Shanghai, but you know, when I do these books, often I do the place because it's a great excuse to go back and do research, which in my case often just means walking the streets, but still you're there. And I have been to Shanghai, but then the pandemic hit and effectively closed it out. So this will be a novel written by a little time spent there, but not nearly enough. I would have loved to have gone back, but it's going to be totally out of my head. On the other hand, it's set in 1939, and you know, who's to say it isn't the way it was? If you do enough of the research, you don't necessarily see it now.
Yeah. But
extraordinary place and time, and it's very rich material in any case, but we'll see what we'll see.
I'm sure it'll be wonderful. Wow. So it was wonderful to hear that both of you have, you know, coming projects. I love it. So Patrick, come and join us and see if there are any questions that the audience might have.
All right, let's see. Here we go. Yeah, let me see here. Oh yeah, okay, so there are a couple of them here. Renee would like to know, did your husband know that you were in the CIA?
Yes. So you can tell your closest, they recommend that you tell your closest friends and family, because that can get kind of awkward if they don't know. So we weren't married at the time, but we were dating, so. Yes.
Let's see. Some of these you've kind of answered already. Do you speak any other languages fluently?
I used to speak Farsi. So after I got back from Baghdad, I spent a year learning Farsi, the language of Iran, for my next assignment, which was going to be in Afghanistan. But at that point, I had had enough. So after I learned Farsi, I resigned. So unfortunately, my Farsi has faded. I'm not that fluent anymore.
You've been back to Bahrain?
No, I don't know if I could even get in after publishing this book, to be honest. I mean, we were there, we had, you know, diplomatic passports for my husband's job, but so I don't know if I could get in now. I'd probably have to have a visa.
It's interesting that Bahrain's been in the news recently, and the Fifth Fleet, you know. I can't remember, is it because there's been a shift in policy in the, I think that's what I read. I'm thinking of a New York Times story, which I'm vaguely recalling now.
I'm trying to remember, yeah, because I remember you mentioning that, and I don't remember the news item.
Joe, do you remember this?
No.
Okay, I'll have to look at it. But anyway, there was some question about the influence of the Fifth Fleet and whether it should be headquartered in Bahrain. And, you know, because once we withdrew from Afghanistan and our focus is now more on China and so forth, then there's, you know, a question about whether we're, how much we value the Bahrain thing and how much we're putting into it, the whole bit. So it's interesting. I sometimes think that there's a weird thing in the zeitgeist that, you know, a book will come along and somehow events seem to come along with it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I definitely think it has a lot of unresolved issues in Bahrain. I mean, I think that it still has this sort of simmering kind of cold war there, you know, with Iran backing the revolutionaries, and Saudi Arabia backing the monarchy, and that's not going to change anytime soon. And the U.S. is stuck in the middle because it has its Fifth Fleet there, and it plays a very kind of, it has a very delicate dance, the U.S., you know, trying to appease its sometime ally, Saudi Arabia, you know, we're afraid of Iran, and it's a very kind of delicate dance, and I don't think that's going away anytime soon.
The world is full of hotspots. It really is, no matter where you look. Sorry, Patrick, anything else?
You may have already answered this. Forgive me if you have. Renee asks, when you worked overseas for the CIA, were there many other women that worked with you?
So that would be in Baghdad. There were a few, not a lot. It was a heavily male profession. And I had volunteered to go to Baghdad, and there weren't a ton of female volunteers, but there weren't a ton of women in general at the agency. So yeah, and that goes back to my point that I wanted a kind of typical spy for my protagonist, more men than women.
And how long did it take you to write this novel?
So it took me maybe about 3 years to write and 2 years to edit, I would say. I started when my son went off to school, so I had the school day hours to work, but I didn't really work during summers because he was home. So it wasn't 5 continuous years, but more or less.
And let's see here. Did you always know that you wanted to be a novelist? Was that always a dream that you had?
I definitely always loved writing and wanted to be a writer, for sure. But I don't know about you, Joe, but I felt like I couldn't support myself as a reader growing up. So I didn't really entertain it seriously as a career. And I also didn't have a good story to tell at the time. I mean, I think I had several failed attempts at novels along the way. And then once I was a spy, that was the experience that really stuck with me.
Wow, that is a great title that you just mentioned. Once I was a spy. That's a fabulous title. I love it. Right?
Once when I was a spy. Good.
Once I was a spy. Yeah, no, terrific. I think, you know, hang on to that one. Might be very good. Actually, I wanted to ask you, since you were writing this, you know, really on your own without support, did you learn a lot of your craft from reading, like, say, Joe Cannon and other masters of this genre?
100%. No question. I mean, like I said, I don't think there are a ton of literary spy novelists out there. And to me, Joe, you're like at the top of the heap. So I was just, I mean, that was like such an inspiration. The fact that there were spy novels that, you know, I think I said this before the show, but that are character driven. I mean, I just didn't see that out there. You were like one of the only ones doing it. And that was such a huge inspiration to me.
The reason I love Joe's work so much is that he doesn't repeat himself. He's, you know, it's not a like a series, but it's a wonderful tour around the world in different spots. I love that about you, Joe, that you remember when you were in Istanbul and I dropped you an email and you wrote me back and said, you know, he was sitting on the balcony at then, because they moved it, the Istanbul Modern, looking back at the city, you know, looking back at Topkapi and all. And I thought, well, I've been there and had lunch there too. So, you know, it was kind of a bond. But
I remember the actual email said, this comes to you from the shores of the Bosphorus or something like that, because you had sent me to New York, not knowing that I was out of the country.
True. I think that's one of the reasons that every book you have you write has such an impact, is that it's always a new, it's like a whole new world, you know. I mean, your characters are new, but you are exploring new landscapes. And I mean, your period is relatively circumscribed, although you wandered in and out a bit. But I love it in that we get to see so much more of the world than if you were writing, let's say, you know, all British all the time or whatever it might be.
Well, I hope so. It's interesting. My first book was set in 1945, and then the most recent was 1963. And my wife said, if you just keep going, you one day will write a contemporary novel. Wanted me to do. Except,
well, don't you think the historical perspective is part of what you like about doing it?
I do. I mean, I think the metaphor that's frequently used is if you're in the middle of a battle scene, you have no idea really what's going on. You really have to get some distance from it to figure things out. I think that's true about historical writing. But as to your point about literary fiction, I think that it's a genre that lends itself to it if you take it seriously. I recently finally got around to reading the Le Carré letters. You know, it's a huge book, mm-hmm. A lot of letters. But one of the things that fascinated me as you go through it is how seriously he took it. And this was a really serious writer. He was at a certain point, he was more famous than God and certainly very rich, and he could have just had a good time. It never occurred to him. I mean, he was back to his desk, writing. And it's almost that I must be about my father's business kind of sensibility. And deeply admirable. And you think, well, one of the reasons there is such a body of work there is that he took it seriously as a body of work, that it wasn't just getting lucky with a movie contract. So I wish the same for you. I hope you write as many books as Le Carré. It would be good for all of us.
And then you don't have the family baggage that Le Carré had.
Yeah. Or the father.
Yes. You know, somebody wrote a biography of Fakhari with his permission, is the way I understand this. And then he wasn't too crazy about the results. So then he wrote a memoir of his own, which you probably have read, Joe. I can't quite remember that. It has a strange title. Do you remember
what it was called? Pigeon Tunnel.
Thank you, The Pigeon. And but the thing that struck me the most about it was he had this ghastly father. I mean, he was a con man. He was just, you know, a complete wastrel or whatever it is, and drove Lacari crazy almost all his life. And yet he wrote that without any bitterness, you know? I mean, he really did.
A loyal to the family to the end. I mean, even in his last years, he's writing to the brother. He's taking care of the father when he can. I mean, the father is a complete Dickensian character. He's really a con man, as you say. He's a crook, a shyster. And the legacy haunts Lacari for all of his life, but he never truly turns his back on these people. I mean, when he can afford to, he helps them out, etc. It's quite an interesting life.
Very interesting life. He was really kind to us. I mean, it never occurred to me that we would have any contact with him. And we had a customer who totally escapes me who it might be, who said to me one day, well, why don't you ask him if he'd sign some books for you in the UK? And I thought, seriously? You know, I mean, how could I do that? And the guy said, well, you know, here's his address, David Cornwall in Cornwall, whatever. So I wrote to him and he said, sure. Well, it was more elegant than that. But anyway, so for quite a while, his publisher in London would send him books down to Cornwall and he would sign them and then they would go back to London and come to us. And I thought, wow, I mean, that was an incredibly approachable, you know, man for who he was. It would never have entered my mind that do you remember that, Patrick, when we...
Yeah. Particularly since he had a reputation for not being cooperative with...
No, so maybe he was selective. I have somewhere behind me, I have three autographed John Le Carre books, you know, which I will treasure forever. And he signed them Le Carre. He didn't sign them David Cornwall. He stuck to his pen name, but... You know, he was really a fascinating character all the way around.
Obviously, you know, a man of conscience. I mean, that showed throughout all of his work, I think, anyway. Kind of issues of social justice and things like that.
They're serious books. Yeah.
Yeah. Joe, who, besides Le Carre, who are some of your role models? Are you a Graham Greene fan?
Oh, sure. You know, look, it's always flattering to be compared to writers that you like. Graham Greene is the one that you most treasure being compared to, because I think he's a really good, serious writer. And you would like to think of yourself that way, whether you are or not. I mean, nobody has that kind of level of self-consciousness. But if it could be someone else, that's somebody I deeply admire. I love the books. But, you know, strictly speaking, people will say, who influenced you? And everybody influences you. I mean, everything you read feeds into the sensibility that's going to be apparent in your books. Just selecting the words you select, it's not even necessarily conscious. You're just doing it. So I think that the fact that I like Graham Greene's work, yes, if someone says you're in that mode, what they really are talking about is The Third Man. I mean, everybody's talking about a movie and what kind of atmosphere it's imbued with. But the same could be said for Ian Fleming, who we were just talking about, or anyone one has ever read, and particularly if you've enjoyed the work, it, I think, just seeps into this sort of greater literary consciousness that people use when they're writing books.
Yeah. Think about Eric Ambler. I mean, we haven't even mentioned him, for example, another seminal figure. And I'm trying to remember a British author that Martin Edwards brought back after I prodded him in the British Library Crime Classics. They did a couple of espionage things. And J. Philip Oppenheim, and it would come to me. That's the thing about getting older, Joe, is it's hard to do names, isn't it? It's like, where is it? I don't know, but I mean, he's another wonderful writer. I think that, you know, there's so many really great classics in espionage and spy fiction that, you know, we would really think of as literary more than action. And I'm wondering, you know, in some degree, if action has taken over. So that's one reason I thought your book was so wonderful, Alana, is that it's in that more classical tradition, I think.
Thank you. I mean, and that's also what I love about Joe's books, that I agree with you. So many spy novels now are car chases and, you know, shoot 'em up type books. And I much prefer Joe's type of novels.
Yeah. A more cerebral kind of aspect to it. Yeah.
Well, there were some, you know, the late Philip Kerr had one or two that I think were much more spy novels than they were police procedurals or whatever. Some really
Alan First is another
one. Alan First too, right? I'll still remember, it was his third book, I think, the Paris something, or the, I can't remember, it's the one that you know, he emerged from kind of obscurity into leapt into fat. And I'm trying to remember which one it was, but do you remember it, Joe? It started in Budapest and then it was mostly in Paris.
Yes, and I just can't remember the title at the moment.
Me either.
Of course, it was a dark star.
Alan Pierce, there were spies of the Balkans, spies of Istanbul.
Those were much later. Yeah.
Now he went around too. But
it's embarrassing to note this because I used to be his editor. But anyway, the books that I preferred were Night Soldiers.
Night Soldiers.
One set in the Balkans, I think, are just wonderful.
Yeah.
Polish Officer was good.
The Polish Officer is one.
Very good. Right. Terrific. So I'd like to conclude this by reading Joe's jacket blurb for Alana, which he wrote because he loved the book. And before we agreed to do this paragraph, I said to Joe, because sometimes authors do blurbs for reasons that are not necessarily because they are in love with the book. So Joe and I have known each other a long time, and I knew he'd be honest. And I said to him, so was this a real blurb? And he wrote back, absolutely. So here's what he said. The peacock and the sparrow is that rare thing, a genuine page turner that also has something to say. A sharp, knowing look at today's CIA with the moral complexities of the best spy fiction and a Persian Gulf setting so richly detailed and immediate, you feel you could reach out and touch it. A remarkable debut. Wow, Alana, you know, if nothing else in your life ever comes up to that level, you've hit the peak.
I agree. This is all just the pinnacle.
It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you for signing so many books for us. This is our June first mystery or first fiction book of the month, which is why we only have a very few copies left, but I urge you to grab one while you can. And now we can all sit back and wait for Joe to announce when his book is publishing. Does it have a title?
Shanghai.
Shanghai? Just Shanghai?
It's called Shanghai. Yes.
Wow. Well, anyway, I'm excited because anytime I get to spend with Joe is time well spent. I love it. So thank you all very much for joining us this afternoon. Bye, guys. Thanks a lot.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.